The initiating event was this attempted assassination of Franklin Roosevelt after he'd been elected, but before he was inaugurated.
You're listening to The Brian D. O'Leary Show, your sanctuary for serious content in an unserious culture.
Welcome back to The Brian D. O'Leary Show. Joining us today, three-time Pulitzer Prize nominee and former Rolling Stone editor, spent his career pulling back the curtain on topics that most journalists stay far away from. Now with his new book, The First All-Star Game, Babe Ruth, FDR, and America at the Crossroads, he's taken us inside the summer of 1933. Please welcome the master of narrative investigative fiction and author of The First All-Star Game, Randall Sullivan.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
You bet. Now, Randall, I want to talk about the book quite a bit because it's all the subjects I love. I was a history major, a huge baseball fan of the every topic you talk about in this book. So the conversation could be rich, but we don't have much time. But I first want to get into one question. I grew up in Portland, Oregon, and I believe you did too. Is that correct?
I grew up there from the time I was 12 years old. We moved there from the coast when I was 12.
Okay. Sunset High School, as I recall?
That is right.
All right. Metro League rivals. I went to Jesuit High School. So we're not going to hold it against you today because we're going to dive into baseball. Although the Apollos knocked us off, they were the state champions when I was in high school in baseball. So got that going for you. okay. First, I want to talk about the book in general. I think it's a history, like I said, 1933, but really, you go back decades and then you bring it a little further after the aftermath of 1933. Tell us how you decided on this topic.
It was born out of the fact that I was feeling pretty discouraged about the condition of the country, especially the level of polarization and animosity between people. And it seemed almost like the country was coming apart. And I thought, but we've survived worse things.
When did you start this project?
In 2024.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Am I going to say that? Yeah.
So the analysis is quite fair for my.
Yeah. So I thought, well, we've survived worse things. I've thought about the Civil War. And then I thought, well, and even more recently, the Great Depression. I began to read about the Great Depression, just to realize what the country had come through and how much people had felt that, the country was literally going away. And I saw that it sank steadily, and then it started to tick back slowly in the late spring and summer of 1933. And I was thinking, well, what happened aside from Roosevelt becoming president and making some of the decisions he did? The two events that were the most outstanding were the Chicago World's Fair and this exhibition baseball game that was played as part of the Chicago World's Fair that turned out to be the first All-Star game.
Right. And they had the big leagues hadn't had anything like this for what they never really had an All-Star game. It was the Addie Joss when he died in the early 1910s or something. And then Cleveland played a group of All-Stars, and that was the only thing for 20 plus years, right?
Yeah, they were like touring so-called All-Stars, but they weren't, the best players, and they weren't voted fans like in this case. So, it came about through, an amazing, a set of circumstances you wouldn't believe if you didn't know they were actually true.
Yeah, well, tell us about that. That's how you start the book, and I agree, it was one of these things that it's like, reading it and some might call it the chain reaction or the domino effect of life or baseball or the United States. So tell us a little bit of background of how it got started.
Well, the initiating event was this attempted assassination of Franklin Roosevelt after he'd been elected, but before he was inaugurated. And he was in Miami. We'd done fishing trips, speaking to a crowd when this guy stood up out of the crowd and tried to assassinate him. and sprayed six bullets as people were grabbing at him. Not a single bullet hit Roosevelt, amazingly, but they hit everybody around him, including the mayor of Chicago, Anton Cermak. And Cermak held on for a while, but died 3 weeks later. And so Chicago, and Cermak, by the way, was in Miami because he was trying to get away from a trial that was happening in Chicago, in which it was testified that he had, you know, ordered a hit by Chicago policemen on Frank Nitti, who had inherited the crime syndicate from Al Capone, who'd just gone away. And so they were all the newspaper men were waiting anxiously for Cermak to come back so they could question him. But unfortunately for them, he died in a hospital in Miami. So the guy who actually ran Chicago, who was a sewer contractor, believe it or not, selected this guy, Edward Nash, as the new mayor. And Chicago was going to have a World's Fair, which it itself, the fact that that existed was amazing because, you know, it was such a huge event to put on and at such a low point. But as it happened, the people of Chicago had voted for a bond to finance the fair on October 28th, 1929, the day before the stock market collapsed. And so they were stuck with it in a way. So anyway, Mayor Nash takes over and wants to, you know, do something that put his stamp on it. And so he thinks, we need to have some great athletic contest. And he's thinking a horse race or a boxing match. But he goes to the publisher of the Chicago Tribune, Colonel McCormick, who says, well, you know, my sports editor is one of the great promoters in the world. Let's bring him in. So Arch Ward, the sports editor, comes in and meets with them and says, no, it should be a baseball game between the best players in the American League and the best players in the National League. So it was staged as a one-off exhibition. It was called the Game of the Century at the time. And that is now
had several of those since.
Yeah. That was the first time that was ever used. Okay. So it was billed across the country. It probably got more build up, more press than any sporting event in American history up to that point. Yeah, which was because people bought in. I mean, nobody going in knew whether people who were strapped to the limit would want to pay for these tickets, but or if the players themselves or the team owners would, you know, anybody would want to be part of it. And the biggest concern immediately was, does Babe Ruth want to be part of this? Because Babe Ruth was, you know, I think no matter what we think the legend of Babe Ruth is, he was even bigger than we think.
I was going to say, yeah, like it just keeps growing too. In this book and several other books I've read over the last few years, one being Jane Levy's book and Thomas Wolfe, who we had on the show, he wrote The Called Shot, and he wrote another book about baseball in the Roaring Twenties and dives into, you know, Babe Ruth. I mean, this guy was, and I guess, like I said, the more I read about him, the more I'm just enamored of, you know, not necessarily his personal life, but just the legend and the outsized
His greatness and his ability to rise to the
everything
moment.
Everything above it. Everything about it.
I mean, his stats are, when you actually look at them in the context of baseball, he towers above on that too, but it still doesn't kind of make people understand how compelling he was to the American people. One thing that does, and I don't know that this has been published previously, maybe it has, but you know, when Babe was out with sick illness and, you know, missed most of the 1925 season, attendance at American League games dropped by 34%. Now, people always say, well, when you say, well, Babe Ruth was by far, you know, the most significant athlete in American history, said people say, what about Michael Jordan? Well, if Michael Jordan had been injured in a season, you know, maybe NBA attendance would have dropped by 3.4%, probably not that. But without Babe Ruth, it dropped by 34%. That's how big he was.
Yeah. And I think he had another season, 1922, where you touch on that in the book a little bit.
He was suspended. That's a lot of this.
Yeah. He got suspended. He played in like 109 games or something like that, which is still a lot of games, but he ended up with like 39 home runs, close like 95 RBIs, which is a great year just in general, but a fellow Oregonian of ours from Grants Pass, Oregon, led the American League in home runs that year, Ken Williams.
Yeah, that's it. That's good point.
I like to bring that up to other bases. Oregon doesn't have
nobody remembers him. You're right. It's up. Well, I mean, consider this. We generally, although wins above replacement might be it may be somewhat flawed, but it is generally considered the most representative statistic of greatness in a player. The top three WARs of all time in the major leagues are Babe Ruth's. And he has 6 of the top 13, and it would have been 8 of the top 13, except for those 2 seasons he missed. There's like 4 other players who had 2 of the top 24 WARs. Nobody else has had more than 1. So that's how much far above Babe Ruth is. And his lifetime WAR is more than twice the highest WAR of an active player, with Mike Trout. So he was an extraordinary.
And I think you talk about it. So the book, like I said, the scope is humongous, and you talk a lot about Babe Ruth in this book, but it's not a biography of Babe Ruth. You talk a lot about Chicago, but it's not a history of Chicago. You talk about all these different characters, but you know, the one thing about Babe Ruth is that before he gets sold to the Yankees, which the details you provide for that is like, I forgot, or I didn't know like half of the things.
Oh, completely. The Yankees fleeced the Red Sox.
Oh, just unbelievable. But he was considered a good hitting pitcher.
Yeah.
And a great pitcher.
Excellent pitcher. Yeah.
And then he just, you know, after the 1919 season, I think it was only real playing in the outfield primarily for the Red Sox. And he, you know, he didn't have the great season that he had the next year with the Yankees, but it's like he takes off into the stratosphere.
He did shatter the all-time home run record in that season. But what he did the next season was what?
I bring up 1919, and you dive into the Black Sox scandal for quite a good portion of this book, and which brings us. So there's been a number of books written, and I'm glad you talked about the movie Eight Man Out, which I love that movie. I think it's a great movie. I think the history is poor, as you point out in the book. But you had 2 characters there primarily, are Charles Comiskey, owner of the Chicago White Sox, which brings this again full circle, like why is Chicago the setting of this book and why is it so important? And Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who's a judge in Chicago. And he becomes essentially the czar of baseball, like it or not. And my opinion of Landis hasn't really changed a whole lot over the years. I don't like him as a character, but what you point out in this book is that he had a humongous populist appeal to the nation at large because of all these things that had gone on, and he was a larger than life figure himself. So.
Well, he was enormously well-known and popular as a judge. He was better known than most Supreme Court justices because of the rulings he made against the so-called fat cats, in particular, the ruling he made against John D. Rockefeller at the time.
Which got overturned in the next level up, right?
It did, but to the people, you know, it was like, well, there's at least one judge out there who will stick it to these guys who can't be bought. And so he was, you know, considered a man of, you know, great rectitude, and baseball desperately needed someone to rehabilitate its image. And so he was chosen, and they gave him more control over baseball than anybody had ever had over any aspect of American culture up to that time.
Hey everyone, quick break. If you're enjoying this conversation about Babe Ruth, the 1933 All-Star Game, and baseball's biggest legends, you need to join our roster over at Unrelenting, the O'Leary Review. We're stepping up to the plate with exclusive historical deep dives and sports analysis you won't find anywhere else. So don't get caught looking. Head over to O'LearyReview.com right now and hit subscribe. Now back to the show. Because before he took over, it was essentially you had a commission in charge of baseball. So people don't realize that all of a sudden Landis comes in and they never had a commissioner. They kind of did. They had the president of the American League, president of the National League, and ironically, the owner of the Cincinnati Reds was on the commission.
Who really was the most powerful person in baseball.
Correct. But I was like, oh yeah. It's coming full circle when Bud Selig, for whatever reason, became the commissioner of baseball after being an owner. But I mean, so it did come full circle again. But Landis, he turned around baseball, but he wanted to nitpick every rule. And then so Babe Ruth, he got stuck in the crosshairs there of Landis a couple different times.
You know, look, Landis had an enormous ego, was very vain, but he also felt compelled to impress upon everybody that baseball is by the book and rules will be enforced. And even Babe Ruth is going to have to play by the rules. And so even when it was a petty, stupid rule in this case, Landis used it to, take out a lot of the 1923 season for Babe.
The barnstorming rule, right? Where the players could not barnstorm, meaning all-stars or a big league player.
If their team had played in the World Series, if they hadn't played in the World Series, they could. But if they had, if they'd gotten World Series money.
So the barnstorming tours that we hear about, Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, all these guys would get their teams together and then travel the country. They go East Coast, West Coast, Southern Swing, whatever. They play in the off season. This was essentially the all-star circuit, more or less, before, except it wasn't pitching the absolute best against the absolute best. That has happened pretty much every year, except for 2020, since.
Yeah, the all-star game?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the All-Star game, there's been two seasons missed, one during World War II and then during the COVID lockdown. But it's been played every year, except those of the last 93 years.
Yeah, no, and that's amazing. And Arch Ward, you mentioned him earlier, and he comes from the columnist at the Chicago Tribune who really launched this thing. And he comes in the after Hugh Fullerton, who was another journalist for the Chicago Tribune that was enormously popular and powerful in the 1919 era of the Black Sox thing. But Ward, like I said, right coming right after that, he was popularized the whole Newt Rockne, Notre Dame, George Gipp.
He did. I mean, His biography is called Arch, a Promoter, Not a Poet, because he wasn't much of a writer, but he was one heck of a promoter. And he proved that early on with the whole win one for the Gipper line that he spread all over the country. And I'm not sure, and I don't think anybody can be, that Rockne ever actually said that. But it was in every paper in the country and became the most famous line in the history of football, probably, and maybe even American sports.
Yeah. Thanks to future president.
Yeah.
Ronald Reagan.
That's right.
Perhaps. So let's stay in Chicago here for a moment and kind of work our way up to the All-Star game, if you can. You had the 1919 scandal. The guys from the White Sox played the 1920 season and most of the 1921 season. And that's when the trial was. The trial was not Judge Landis. It was a trial in Chicago. Ended up, all eight players, the eight men out, they were all acquitted, as were the gamblers. And so this becomes, and then Landis comes in, and then he ends up banning all eight for life. Well, now they're not banned as of Manfred's rule last year, but that's beside the point. But I think what happened here is that you had a trial made up of jury of their peers, and it became a kind of a class war, almost.
It did. The lawyers for the players and the gamblers, but mainly the lawyers representing the players, managed to make this a contest between these hard scrabble blue collar guys and a very, you know, kind of an elite sliver of the White Sox team, which was led by Eddie Collins, who had graduated from Columbia. So he was this Ivy Leaguer and the you know, the pet of the owner, and, you know, he was paid well, but they weren't. And so, you know, they did a really good job of kind of, you know, arousing the sense of injustice in this jury of blue collar people. But all through, across the rest of the country, that decision was hugely unpopular. You know, the rest of America was outraged, and
they wanted justice. Americans wanted justice,
and they wanted to believe in the game of baseball.
Yeah, and another character in there, and you talk again, 1919. He doesn't quite finish the 1919 season. John McGraw is the manager of the New York Giants, and there's a fella, first baseman, very good player, Hal Chase, who actually was from the town that I live in Los Gatos, California, which is very, very interesting how these parallels continue in my life. But he was notorious throughout the league, and everybody knew he was throwing games. And oftentimes it was games that didn't really matter. But as we see in this latest last few years, when gambling is not really it's considered okay again, kind of, and like it was back then. And these guys are getting caught for throwing games or throwing innings that don't really matter.
Shaving points. Yeah.
Shaving points. I went to Boston College. We had a couple of point shaving scandals there, you know, one in basketball in the 70s. And when I was in college in the 90s, they had the football deal, and good grief. So anyway, look, Hal Chase gets, he's the first domino to fall in this whole thing, I guess is what I'm.
Yeah, he was. I mean, they banned him even before the Black Sox were expelled. So that was sort of a signal that, you know, gambling's, you know, we're going to start cracking down on gambling. But it was, and it wasn't just the Black Sox. I mean, I guess what could be said for Landis is that he really did stamp gambling out of baseball. He forced, you know, the two best players before Babe Ruth, Ty Cobb and Tris Speaker, out of the game, because when he
temporarily, yeah.
So yeah, I mean, but they did both retired.
Well, then they came back, but they did come back first. They moved teams. Cobb goes from Detroit to Philadelphia, and Speaker goes from Boston to Cleveland, I think it was.
But neither of them was really the same player.
Oh no, that was like the tail end of their career. Or no, Speaker joined them in Philadelphia too, I believe. Anyway, yeah, and so I'm interested in this Black Sox thing, and I have been for ever since I was a kid. But another interesting thing about this trial or the scandal is that, you know, we try and make sense of who did what. Buck Weaver, you know, he knew about it maybe, but he didn't do anything bad. Joe Jackson said he took some, you know, took some money, but he had the best series of anybody in the whole deal. But what it ended up being, and what I think Eight Men Out, the movie, you can kind of start to get the inklings of it, but it really was the players and these gamblers double crossing each other, and all these different gamblers double crossing each other. And so nobody really knew what was going on. I think maybe the guys were probably afraid of their lives more than anything if they didn't follow through.
The chief witnesses at the trial described it as cheaters cheating cheaters. And to the jury, it's like, well, do we really care about cheaters cheating cheaters? And you know, so, you know, I mean, in Joe Jackson's case, I mean, I understand he is a very sympathetic character. He did take money and with a promise that he would, you know, throw games. But he then also played great in most of the series.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, he's lionized in the films of the late 80s as such a great player. But, and, you know, you said, he's sympathetic to a large degree. But maybe as a, you know, again, this book covers way more than what we're able to talk about today. And, you know, the history of a great period piece of the United States. I think to mobsters, all this stuff. It's great. So maybe as a conclusion here, as you wrote this, or maybe even after you wrote it, who do you think, maybe one character or historical person in this entire drama, whose reputation do you think has been most sanitized by the modern culture that does deserve a bit more blame than they get in this culture? Would it be Jackson? Would it be somebody else?
Well, I mean, you know,
Landis, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be Landis. I mean, you know, various people have been, you know, vilified for things that happened after the game, later in their careers.
Or maybe a better question, Randall, would be, who got the rawest deal in the history books? Who really was?
Well, for a long time, that answer would have been Chuck Klein, because he was a truly, truly great player. He was the best hitter in the National League. He was, you know, they knocked him because he played at the Baker Bowl, which was a smallish ballpark. But he hit, you know, everywhere, you know. I mean, they called him the Babe Ruth of the National League, and his career ended sort of pitifully because he sort of drank himself out of baseball and drank himself out of life. But somehow the idea that he really wasn't as good as his statistics showed, you know, got into the heads of sports writers. And
is it because Babe Ruth was so outsized in the other league, and they didn't necessarily play against each other, or was there other?
Maybe. And it was also just that I think that, you know, Chuck Klein faded. I mean, actually, now I'm thinking, if you wanted to ask me who's got the most unfair deal in terms of the Hall of Fame, I'd say Lefty O'Doul.
Okay. Yeah. He was a big San Francisco guy. He had a bar, and, you know, I think they moved it or closed it.
Hugely popular restaurant bar in San Francisco, but he was a great player. I mean, the main knock from the Hall of Fame is that he had, you know, he only played 11 seasons in the majors.
He had two different careers. He had a career as a pitcher and as an outfielder. And he was in that All-Star game, wasn't he? That first All-Star game.
He was indeed. Yeah, he voted in despite Arch Ward kind of trying to convince people he didn't belong. So, because the fans love him, especially the West Coast fans, because he's, you know, a lot of his good years were in the PCL. But what he did aside from that, you know, along with being the winningest manager in the history of the Pacific Coast League, is he was more instrumental than anybody in bringing baseball to Japan and developing baseball in Japan. Just on that basis, he deserves consideration. But I mean, the guy also hit 398, you know, with 254 hits, you know, is still tied for the most hits in the National League in a season. And that was not in 162 games. It was 154. So he had a lot of seasons. Like, he was a great hitter. And, you know, his impact on the game overall, I'd say, you know, rivals, you know, certainly, you know, many of the people were in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, well, that might be a good place to end it. I appreciate it, Randall. Again, the book is The First All-Star Game, Babe Ruth, FDR, and America at the Crossroads. Atlantic Monthly Press comes out today, June 2nd, 2026. Go out and get the book. We'll have it in the show notes. Any last words, Randall?
I just want people to understand, and I think the book will help them do that, that this was more than a game. And it was more than the inauguration of a tradition. It was a turning point in American history.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. I appreciate your time once again, Randall, and best of luck with the book.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You bet. All right. And that's a ball game for today's episode. A huge thanks to Randall Sullivan for taking us back to the summer of 1933. Now, if you love pulling back the curtain on the Black Sox scandal, Babe Ruth's outsized legend, and the birth of the All-Star Game, then you need to add Unrelenting, the O'Leary Review, to your daily lineup. That's where you can also get the link to Randall's brand new book, The First All-Star Game, Babe Ruth, FDR, and America at the Crossroads. That's from Atlantic Monthly Press, published June 2nd, 2026. Now, here on the podcast, we cover a lot of ground, but over on our Substack, Unrelenting, we hit it out of the park. Subscribers get exclusive written content, deeper historical analysis, and unfiltered cultural commentary delivered straight to them. So don't be left warming the bench while we break down the most fascinating stories in history and sports. Step in the batter's box and head on over to O'LearyReview.com to subscribe to Unrelenting today. That's O'LearyReview.com. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time.